Welcome to Mastering the Attention Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Ari Lewis. Twice a week, we interview entrepreneurs, executives, and industry leaders on how to break through the noise and capture the audience's attention. Today's guest is Jason Janowitz. Jason is the co-founder of Blockworks Group, a media company focused on bridging the gap between traditional finance and digital assets.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Jason. So I'm so glad to have you on. You know, been a big fan of Blockworks since I was in the crypto space. And now that I'm out of it, you know, still a big fan of you all because I pay attention a lot to the media space. So what I found really interesting about your business that I wanted to start off on is you guys started as an events business and, you know, you've sort of built out this flywheel. Since then, you have podcasts and other revenue streams. Obviously, that was definitely a good decision with what's going on with COVID. But, you know, can you just talk about like the origins of sort of your business and how you guys kicked off things?
Of course. 2017, crypto was absolutely ripping. And I had worked at a venture firm before in 2016 and just found that it was really, really, really tough to talk to kind of the institutional crowd about the crypto space, right? So if you went to one of the, you know, the LPs, the GPs at the venture firm and told them, that there's this thing called Ethereum, they'd say, okay, tell me more about it. How do I learn more? And you would either send them to Reddit or to Twitter. And I can guarantee you a 70-year-old gray-haired family office investor has no interest in learning about something called Ethereum from like Crypto Bobby on Twitter or like Crypto Panda on Reddit, right? So you kind of get laughed out of the room. And so I linked up with two friends. One was working in finance, one was working consultant. I was a consultant at the time and kind of said like, there's an opportunity to bring crypto to like these institutional folks, whether that meant like Fortune 500 people or the institutional crowd. And so we started hosting, events, and they started as tiny little meetups that, you know, we would wake up at like 4:30, 5 a.m. before our day jobs every morning, message like 200 people per morning before work, and message them on LinkedIn and tell them to buy a $20 ticket to our events. And the first event we ever had, 220 people showed up. My buddy's old company sponsored the event for a whopping $1,500. We bought sushi and pizza. I think we made $11,000. It cost us $7,000. Net came out on top $4,000. And we said, all right, off to the races.
Yeah, I love that story. And it's sort of, you know, I think a lot of people spend all this time like trying to plan it out and be so intentional. And we see that both on like, I think on a personal level on Twitter, everyone's like, what's your niche? But you just found a problem and, you know, you sort of went after it. So that's like a really good playbook that, you know, I hope more people follow. But once you started doing the events business, you know, how long before you started, you know, building out that flywheel of, you know, adding more things to the business? And why did you decide, you know, not to be a purely driven events business? Obviously, there's a lot of companies out there like a Terrapin that, you know, only does events.
Yeah. I mean, just to be totally clear, like this was not we had no grand vision, right? Like we're launching a media company. The best way to launch a media company is with events. The flywheel for a media company is this. Niches make riches. We had none of that. It was just like, why are there no events for institutional folks trying to learn about crypto? Okay, there's nothing on Eventbrite. Let's go host it. That started. We had our first event February of 2018, and then we had our second event May 15th of 2018, which for anyone in crypto, that's like, you know, New York Blockchain Week, which is the big thing. And we were so overwhelmed that we really believed in the thing that, again, didn't believe in it as a grand vision of a bigger company, but believed in it as like, all right, we can make some money, more money from this than we can from our day job. So we quit our jobs on May 1st of 2018. Hosted that next event, lost a bunch of money, thought we were idiots. And then in July of 2018, we had our third event. I cold emailed this guy, Anthony Pompliano, 13 times. He finally responded and said, if you stop emailing me, I'll come speak at your event. Just please stop harassing me. So he came. I auto-subscribed him to our newsletter, definitely not GDPR compliant. He messaged, you know, Mike and myself after about a month and said, who are you guys? What do you do? We went into Morgan Creek in August of 2018. He said, do you guys know how to create a podcast? Mike and I said, absolutely. Went home and Googled how to create a podcast. And that's what you now know of as the Pomp Podcast, or what originally launched as Off the Chain. So I think these preconceived notions and that like entrepreneurs launch companies to solve a problem and their grand vision of $1 billion and they know the exact flywheel and they've read the books is actually causes entrepreneurs not to launch companies in the first place.
So do you think that was a big advantage for you all that you didn't have that traditional media background or you didn't have, you know, obviously crypto is new, but you guys weren't, you know, in the space previously, really, like you didn't work at a Coinbase or Kraken or, you know, had a fund. Do you think that was advantageous to you all and how you guys grew the company and, you know, got it to where it is today?
Wildly advantageous. I do. I think the lack of knowledge, and it's something that now you can never get back, right? You can, unless we go into another industry for our second company or third company, like you can never get that lack of experience back, I'd say, which is something that first-time entrepreneurs don't realize that is actually an advantage that they have, right? And so if you think about like media companies, I didn't understand that there was B2B media versus B2C media. I didn't understand that like everyone was moving from advertising to subscriptions. I didn't understand that social media was eating the lunch of B2C media companies. I didn't get any of that, right? But what we did understand, we knew one thing, which was we did not want to take venture money. And we knew one other thing, which is we didn't want to build a company that didn't make money, right? Because the money was that we made was paying our salaries. And if we didn't want to raise venture money, right? So the only other option is to build a profitable company. And so that's what we did. Now there ended up being problems with that, right? We brought several podcasts into our network, didn't understand the concept of not owning distribution. We don't own some of those podcasts. There are problems there. But what I'm really proud of is that we were able to build a business that does, now nearly $500,000 every month in just top line revenue and is profitable.
Yeah. So, you know, on that note, there's a lot of things to touch on, but the thing that I think struck out to me is you guys didn't raise venture money. You know, why did you choose not to raise venture money? You know, is for those potentially looking to raise in the media game or in adjacent spaces, you know, do you think it's a good idea or do you think it's really just it depended on who you are and what you're building?
I don't necessarily think it depends on who you are. I think it depends on what you want. It depends on two things. The question of whether to raise venture money depends on two things. And I think, you know, working at the venture firm, we saw so many entrepreneurs who successfully raised venture and we would try to convince them to take our venture money, right? And so I saw, but then there are other entrepreneurs who definitely shouldn't. And I think it comes down to two things. One is what type of company are you building? If you're building the next big SaaS company, or you're trying to build rocket ships, or you're trying to build a crypto company that, you need like 30 engineers, definitely raise venture money, because if you don't, you can't build it, right? Like that just comes down to you can't build it and you can't build it fast enough. And if you don't raise 20 million in venture, someone else is going to build it faster. On the flip side, the second you raise venture money, you are no longer your own boss. And for Mike and I, we set out to launch our, this was the first company we had launched, and we had done our own entrepreneurial ventures in like high school and college, but this was the first real company. And so we didn't want to break out on our own and then immediately have a boss. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is I really strongly believe that the most careful thing that an entrepreneur has to think about is their cap table. So you can screw up a hire. You can blow a deal. You can have a customer hate you. You can fix all of those things. It's really, really hard to fix a broken cap table. And so that's just, I think that when you think about raising money, like entrepreneurs should slow down and see if they can try every angle to build without venture money before they go out and have these grandiose dreams of raising a $10 million Series A.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things obviously when you don't raise venture money is you don't really have a large marketing budget. And, you know, for you guys, I think one of the things you all did really well is you've been so good on sort of like this employer and employee branding side of empowering your employees to go out there, post on social media and really help raise the profile of the company. You know, was that sort of a serendipitous thing? Was that a intentional strategy? You know, how did that develop in your culture?
Yeah, I mean, it developed. So Mike and I would wake up before work every morning and message 200 people on LinkedIn to get them to come to our events. And as we started hiring folks, we realized that that was something that was really important to us, was to not spend any money on marketing. A, because, I mean, really just because we couldn't, right? And so if you can't do it, it forces you to get creative. We have made all of our employees post on social media and build their social media presence, whether that's on Twitter or on LinkedIn. Those are the primary, our two primary social media focus points. We make them post on LinkedIn, like, it used to be every day, now it's every week. And what comes out of that is one of our employees, Julie Muroff, she said, "You guys are just making these written posts. I'm gonna make videos of me playing tennis, of me on my walks." And now when we go to events and happy hours, you'll have huge people in the space, people I never would have thought of would know Blockworks. They're coming up to us. I think they're coming up to me, and they walk right past me and go to Julie and say, "Oh my God, you're Julie Muroff. I watch your LinkedIn videos," right? And it's amazing. And I think I don't think anyone can recreate what Barstool did, because there's only one Dave Portnoy, and not to say what he's doing is good or what Barstool's doing is good, but they have a good business model. And I think Morning Brew is also do has done a phenomenal job at that, right? They're nearly bootstrapped. They didn't raise institutional money, raised a little bit of friends and family, but like it forced them to do things like create a really powerful referral system. And so I think when you don't raise money, it forces you to get scrappy.
Yeah, so obviously you had this events business and COVID hit. Can you talk about you guys just had your best month ever on revenue, how you were a prepared sort of for that pivot from moving from these in-person events to these virtual events, and other parts of your business that have done well because of COVID or maybe despite COVID.
Yeah, I would say that we by no means were we prepared. I'd be like making that up, but I think one thing that we did a good job at is asking our customers what they wanted. Just when we sat down, even before COVID, asking. So the way that we make money is primarily sponsorships and advertisements. And so, if you think of mark, like, if you look at a marketing budget and think of it like a pie, what we're doing is we're eating away at the pie. And so you've got like events might make up 10% of a marketer's budget. But then you start thinking to yourself, like, can we take other pieces of that pie, right? And still stay as the same company. So we could go run Facebook ads for one of our clients, but then we're more like an agency, and I don't want to be that. So how can you eat away at your customer's budget while still staying true to your roots and also while still helping your customers get better and be happier, right? And so we sat down with a lot of our best customers, I think like 2 weeks into COVID, and said, "We're struggling, you're struggling, you're the CEO or you're the CMO of your company. How can we come together to just make ourselves both parties really, really happy here?" And like, and good things come out of that. So we signed a deal with a great custodian in the space called BitGo. They wanted to do webinars. We had never done a webinar. We know how to do webinars because they're like virtual events. We had never done it though. And so we sold a, decently sized deal that helped us, with our cash flow, and it helped them drive really high quality leads. We did a six-part series. It was a test run. Neither of us had ever done it, and they just re-signed this week for another large deal of a similar stature. So little things, I think just the best thing we learned from COVID was talk to your customers and also slow down and just think about like COVID gives you time to slow down and think about what you're really building there. So
Yeah, so one of the things that I think you all have done a good job at is, you've been diversified in your business and stuff. One of the things that I think we see so much of is, build out your email list, build out your list, because people are overly reliant on, social media, whether it's Twitter or LinkedIn. Can you talk about like how you think of that, funnel? Is it, okay, we want to meet people like a Julie, have the person meet them through social and then bring them onto your email list or bring them to an event. How do you think about that?
Yeah, of course. I think that's a really good question. So like our basically funnel, right? And or not really funnel, but I'll rephrase it and say like our flywheel is kind of people attend the events, right? So like Ari Lewis attends an event that those attendees can come together for like one 500 person event or a 500 person webinar. Sponsors want to get in front of those people. Those sponsors, then you're able to sell them on like podcast ads and things like that. The podcast ads or on newsletter ads, right? So let's call it newsletter ads. The newsletter ads drive the newsletter writer, right? Because it's money for the newsletter writer or money for the podcast host. More money for the newsletter writer drives more newsletters or more frequency of newsletters. The frequency of newsletters drives more more newsletter readers, or like the frequency of podcasts that you're releasing drives more podcast listeners. More podcast listeners drives more event attendees or webinar attendees. More event attendees drives more sponsorship dollars. And that's our business's flywheel. But again, we're not geniuses. That's every media's flywheel. So that's kind of what we're working with right now.
Yeah. So when you talk about like podcasts in particular, when you you have a deal with Pomp, are people aware that like Blockworks is sort of, you know, part of that? And is he helping drive people to the events? Is it sort of like you're on the back end in a way that, you know, some of these, and probably not the best metaphor, but in the way like an anchor will publish this podcast and no one knows I use Anchor, you know, what do those relationships look like?
It's all dependent, right? And so Jared Dicker, a Washington Post, really bright guy when it comes to media, talks a lot about like media moving towards record labels. And we think a lot about that. And I think we've done a pretty good job. We have 20 podcasts at this point, and none of the podcasts really leave the network. It's just grows kind of month after month. And I think one of the reasons why we've done a good job at this is because a lot of our deals are with the podcast hosts are pretty bespoke. So whereas you said, like you use Anchor for the podcast, or like you use, we're not building a SaaS platform, right? Where like these podcast hosts just come in and plug and play. So there's a lot of different levers that you can pull with the podcast hosts. Revenue share, right? So it might be, hey, we'll do a 50-50 rev share. Like we get 50% of the revenue, but we're also going to produce your show. And you say, I don't need to produce my show. My sister produces my show for me. And we say, okay, great. We'll only take 35% of the revenue. But look, we'll give back 5% of the revenue if we can put the name of our company on the cover of your podcast, right? And so it becomes, and then you might say, I don't want that on the cover, right? And so it becomes pretty bespoke with our podcast shows. And I think that's one of the reasons why folks like us. Is that super scalable? Of course not. Is it what you need to do? When we're only 2 years old. So that's kind of how we've bootstrapped this thing.
Yeah, like the sister metaphor for those of you who don't know, my sister is the one who produces the podcast and does all the audio and visual. So shout out to Courtney out there. But
shout out Courtney.
So you know, I always like to end it on sort of this note of, if you were starting over, you know, what's that like one lesson or that one thing you do differently knowing what you know today?
I would get advisors from day one. We have a few advisors right now that we can lean on, like Sean Griffey from Industry Dive, John Yednak from Aging Media, a large investor who has not invested in the company, but we just lean on him, a guy named Steve Wasserman, a few others. And one of the things that I would do from day one is just get on Twitter, start posting, build your personal brand a little bit, and then just ask for advisors, people that you trust and respect, to come on board and help you. I'm not saying as full-time employees, I'm not even saying as investors. Give them the ability to come onto your website on the team page, or give them a little bit of equity if you feel so inclined to. But like, it's really freaking hard to build a business, and it's a lot easier when you can have the help of people who have done it. So the reason that we like folks like Sean Griffey and like John Yednak is we're building a B2B business company or B2B media company right now. And it's a lot easier when we want to, even if it's like, hey, I want to build a new WordPress site, who's the best developer, all the way up to like, look, I'm thinking about like media companies as record labels. I see what Barstool does. I see what Morning Brew does. Do you think this can be done in the B2B space? Right. And just having those conversations with more experienced folks is, I wish we had done that 2 years ago. So
yeah, that's great advice. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Jason. For those of you listening or watching, you know, how can they find you on social media? How can they find Blockworks, you know, on the internet?
Yeah. Hopefully our SEO is good enough. If you type in Blockworks Group on Google, you can find our website. But no, I'm on Twitter, at Jason Yanowitz. My email, shoot me an email. I'd love to connect with some folks. Jason@blockworksgroup.io. And my DMs are open. So look forward to speaking with some folks soon.
Great. And those links will be in the YouTube and iTunes description. But Jason, thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you, Ari.